Dawn Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT and the free Odyssey app.
EJ and Tony, always great to have you here.
Oh, Dawn, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
Did you like that intro? You give good chart?
I feel like every time I'm on, the intro just gets a little bit better. I love it.
Well, take me through it, and we'll talk about the penny, too, because I know that you had written another great op-ed about the penny and Trump saying that it costs us 3 cents to make one penny, so get rid of it, and so we'll have fun talking about that, too. But I'll start with, and I know that you're very busy putting out some charts minutes ago, so I want to talk about that first, if we can, EJ and Tony. So what are you saying here as far as our consumer prices in the months ahead? Your prediction is that we will see higher consumer prices in the months ahead, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly, Dawn. And a big reason why we know that is we can look at what stores are already paying. In other words, when you go to the grocery store and you grab a gallon of milk off the shelf or half gallon, whatever the case may be, you know, the grocer had to pay for that, obviously, in order to put it on the shelf for you to buy. And so the info that we got this morning, Dawn, was basically looking at the prices that things like people like the grocer pay. In other words, these are the prices paid by businesses, and they're going up very, very quickly in the final months, including the very final month of the Biden administration. That was last month. So that means that we're going to continue to see additional costs passed on to consumers in the months to come. Now, fortunately, we have a lot of things that are coming into place now, which are going to help put downward pressure on prices in the future. But the bad news is that it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Okay. And part of this is energy. Your next post, as you say, if inflation is caused by corporate greed or price gouging, why did prices paid by businesses rise faster than prices paid by consumers? So, I mean, you have all these great graphs and you make it seem so simple, but you're creating these. So how does that work? And then as you're looking at this, and this is your forecast, much like a weather forecast. So EJ and Tony, so like, are you forecasting a short-term turnaround? In other words, you're saying it's going to get worse before it gets better and then smooths out, so to speak. So are we looking for, you know, this is like Groundhog Day, you know, whether Punxsutawney Phil sees his shadow. Are you predicting that, I don't know, by Easter or, you know, are we going to see things start to go down and get better?
Well, the info that we're getting right now, Dawn, points to higher consumer prices, at least for the next couple of months. Now, after that, we got to, you know, reevaluate the forecast and see, okay, what are commodity prices doing? Because those will affect the prices of the things that the producers buy, that things like the factory has to buy, the grocer has to buy, the fuel that the gas station is buying, et cetera. And all of those things are then going to affect consumer prices in the future. So the best data that we have right now points to higher consumer prices in a few months. Again, a few months from now, we can reevaluate and look at those factors again and see, okay, now where does it look like consumer prices are going to go? But to that point that you raised in terms of, you know, what's actually causing the inflation, the Democrats love to talk about, oh, it's corporate greed, it's, you know, it's price gouging, it's all these dirty, dastardly CEOs who are colluding to raise prices on consumers. I would love to know why that all of a sudden magically happened right at the exact same time Biden and the Democrats went on a massive spending spree in the beginning of 2021. My goodness, what a terrible coincidence that was. And in fact, the Biden administration's own data that they produced over the last 4 years shows that that's complete hogwash. And part of that's in the one tweet that you mentioned, mm-hmm. where if you look at how fast prices paid by businesses went up, that actually exceeded how fast prices paid by consumers went up. In other words, you know, going back to that grocery store example, the grocer was paying a much higher price for that gallon of milk than consumers were. In fact, people like grocery stores, they ended up having to shield consumers from somewhere between 10 and 13% of the cost increases seen over the last 4 years. A lot of that was done because producers or store owners were trying to maintain market share.
And so, in other words, they took the hit and tried to mitigate, Is that fair to say they tried to mitigate the hit for us by shielding that, by keeping those prices stable?
Exactly. Yes, that's exactly right, Dawn. And you may then say, okay, but then why is it that if we look at profits, the average profit among corporations, why has that increased so much over the last 4 years? And I would ask people to consider it is up in the exact same way that the average American's weekly paycheck has risen about 16.8%. over the last 4 years, except anyone listening to this, I'm sure, is going to say, wait a second, there is no way I make 16.8% more than I did 4 years ago. And the problem there is the fact that prices have risen so much faster than your income, so that even though the average American's weekly paycheck is up almost 17%, what that larger paycheck buys is down about 4%. Again, that's because prices rose so much faster than incomes. We have seen the exact same thing on the corporate profit side, where nominally those profits are at record highs, but adjusted for inflation, they actually fell over the last 4 years.
And so what impact, and you actually have another chart you put out 18 minutes ago, EJ Antoni, and that one is you're looking at the six measures of inflation, and you're putting out here what you believe is the timing of the impact of the Fed when the Fed cut the interest rates right before the election.
Right. So what happened was last fall, the Fed cuts interest mm-hmm. rates in what I thought was an unprecedented move, frankly, of election interference, where they were trying to get their preferred candidate across the finish line. If anyone has any doubts that the Democrat was their preferred candidate, I ask you to consider that if you look at political donations among people who work at the Fed, over 90% of them go exclusively to Democrats. So that just tells you where the folks at the Fed, what those folks are mm-hmm. thinking. But after they cut those interest rates, what happened to inflation rates? They have accelerated every single month since then. And that's true whether you look at the headline consumer price index or the headline producer price index. Those are consumer inflation and wholesale inflation rates, respectively. And so, again, you have seen that reacceleration of inflation ever since the Fed took their foot off the brake and stomped back on the gas. And the really unfortunate thing is that any positive effects that may have had on the economy happened last fall, but the negative effects are being felt now. In other words, Trump is going to have to pay for the inflation that the Fed caused during the election when Biden was still president.
It's like dine and dash. We pay for the meal. They left us with it. I would ask you, now you're talking about, I think you're alluding in your latest op-ed piece in the Post, EJ Antoni, and that is looking at reducing taxes, burdensome regulations, all of that, making things more business friendly. But what's your warning to Trump in your headline? You know, as you look at this, who would you warn President Trump to watch, to listen to not listen to? And as well, EJ, just your take on, you know, we keep hearing about DOGE. They're going to cut $2 trillion of fat from this budget, that they're not essential services serving, you know, we the people. What's your take on all of that?
Well, in terms of who not to listen to, I think the president needs to just not make the same mistakes he did the first go around, where he basically got snowed by all the rhinos in Congress. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, you know, people like Paul Ryan promised him that they were going to deliver all of these spending cuts if they could just please get one more bloated budget passed through Congress, and Trump acquiesced. And then they basically lied to him and they never delivered on the spending cuts. We forget, because there was so much spending under the first Trump admin, we forget that he actually was railing against that spending the entire time. He was always asking Congress to spend less money, and they never actually did. In fact, he vetoed a spending bill in his final year in office, and Congress overrode him. Mm-hmm. So, again, we forget that Trump is actually, I think, a little bit more of a hawk on spending than he's given credit for. So that's who not to listen to. Who should he listen to? He has an absolute all-star team. He has rock stars in Elon Musk at Doge, in J.D. Vance as his vice president, who is also president of the Senate. Let's remember that. And also, he's got Scott Bessent at Treasury, who is the world's probably greatest mastermind when it comes to sovereign debt markets. So he has an absolute rock star team who can help put together things like a tax cut bill and shepherd that through Congress, who can go through the multi-trillion dollar federal budget and find the abuse, the fraud, the waste, and root all of that out. You know, sunlight is the best disinfectant, Dawn. I think the American taxpayer would be much more outraged at all of the waste that is going on ostensibly in their name using their taxpayer dollars. They would be outraged just if they knew it was happening. And that's where DOGE is so valuable. They are shining light onto all of this, again, abuse, the fraud, the waste, the graft, the kickbacks. And as soon as people find out what is actually going on, they will demand it ends.
So you write in one of your pieces, one of your op-ed pieces, EJ, and that is looking at Trump tariffs. So we keep hearing about the tariffs and working out the deal with Mexico and Canada and China. Where do you stand on this when we think about especially the growing energy exports?
Yeah, I think we have to remember that Trump holds all the cards when it comes to these negotiations. He really does have that Trump card, no pun intended, where if you look at the relative percentage of exports to these different nations, in other words, what percentage of American exports go to Canada and Mexico? It's in the single digits. What about the percentage of Canadian or Mexican exports that come here to the United States? Well, now you're looking at 70, 80, 90%. In other words, the ratio is 10 to 1. And so if you actually do have a tit-for-tat trade war where Trump slaps on tariffs and then the president of Mexico or the governor of Canada slap tariffs on American goods, then what ends up happening? Well, you're going to have an actual full-blown recession in Canada or in Mexico. And here in the United States, it's like the equivalent of an economic speed bump. It's not that big a deal. And so it turns out Trump's not the one who's bluffing. It's the other world leaders who are bluffing, which is why as soon as he threatens these tariffs, literally within hours, the phones are ringing at Mar-a-Lago as those folks are begging to make a deal. Again, doesn't matter if it's the governor in Canada or the president in Mexico. They don't want to go toe-to-toe with Trump in a trade war because they will be the bigger loser. You know, there are no winners in trade wars. There are only losers, but not everyone loses the same.
And what do you make of this? I don't know if we talked about this in the past, the sovereign wealth fund. I'll be honest, I had never heard of this until then Governor Burgum was here in our area at a Trump Force 47 event that I was helping to host and spoke, and he was talking about this. And so Burgum was the one who explained to me this whole thing. And then sure enough, of course, we've heard more about it now. What's your take on this? As I think to most people, this is something that's a new term, sovereign wealth fund, and how that would work. We've heard about it in states, but I mean on a federal or national basis.
Well, imagine this is a bit of a loose analogy here, but imagine that instead of having $36 trillion in debt, we actually had a federal savings account, almost like a rainy day fund. And we had a fund from which we could draw on to pay for things like entitlement spending. It would be something that is essentially such a massive wealth that much like your savings account, it's going to sit there and earn interest for you over time. And then you can even just use the proceeds that you can use those interest payments to pay for things without actually having to tap into the principal, the value in that sovereign wealth fund. So that's the direction that the president would like to head. And again, when you have somebody who's such a sovereign debt mastermind like Scott Bessent at Treasury, I think he's the perfect person to try to run something like this. And essentially what you would have to do before you can really build up that wealth fund, you're going to have to pay down the national debt or maybe even eliminate it entirely. But again, even though that's a long way off, this is still moving in the right direction.
As far as the penny, and I know you've been speaking out about this, and Trump had said, hey, we're spending 3 cents for a penny. And, you know, does it make sense to stop making sense? That was one of the headlines that you had written, which is very clever, EJ and Tony. But what's your take on this as far as the penny? It's you know, we want to pay cash for things on one hand, but the cost of the penny is, I mean, to pay triple for a penny, is that worth it?
Exactly, Dawn. And the simple answer there is no, it's really not worth it. But the other thing that's really important to consider is the fact that you know, the dollar has lost over 90% of its value since 1913 when the Federal Reserve was created. That's a great reason to abolish the Federal Reserve, by the way, but I digress. The fact of the matter is, though, we are measuring transactions with a level of specificity that we have never had before. In other words, why are we still rounding everything to the nearest hundredth of a dollar to two decimal places? We should really just be rounding everything to the nearest tenth of a dollar, a single decimal place. And again, you'd have the same level of exactness then that you did well over 100 years ago. And that seems like a pretty simple decision to me, especially when you consider, as you just outlined, the fact that the federal government is losing so much money, therefore the taxpayer is losing so much money on things like minting coins. And I agree, I don't want to see cash go away. I want to preserve people's ability to transact with physical cash. That's a good thing. I don't want everything to be forced to go digital. That's not the rationale here. The rationale is simply we're losing money on this, and it's an unnecessary level of exactness in our transactions. Why don't we simply just go to back to what we had before, roughly that same level of specificity, and just start rounding everything to the nearest tenth?
It's interesting. I was in the car the other day talking to my teenage son, and he said, well, we need to recycle things. Why don't they just make the penny, make it cheaper, make it out of plastic or rubber? And you could use it for other stuff too, like a coaster. You know, I was like, oh, I kind of like that. That's interesting.
Well, part of the problem, Dawn, is the fact that they already took essentially all the copper out of it. It's just a zinc slug with a wash of copper on it. But the scary thing is the dollar has lost, our currency has lost so much value that the base metal is actually now, again, worth more than a cent, so much so that if you got enough pennies and melted them all down, you could sell the zinc and the very little bit of copper that's there for much more than the equivalent of 1 cent per penny. So again, it's a losing proposition. It is remarkably similar to something that happened in the 19th century when at one point the value of silver became so disconnected from the value of the silver coins being minted by the United States government that as soon as those silver coins went into circulation, they were promptly melted down by the holders of those coins and the silver was resold for its commodity value. That is not a situation that we want to get back to.
That's crazy. So I hesitate to say the R word, and I remember the media will not say the R recession word during some administrations, then all of a sudden they will say it in others. I did see a headline with you involving the R word, EJ Antoni. Are we in a slight recession already?
Well, Dawn, part of the problem here is that a lot of our official government metrics just aren't very good at measuring how people are doing these days. In other words, they no longer reflect the average American's quality of life or standard of living or cost of living for that matter. And that's, I think, a big reason why, as the government continued to spend unprecedented amounts of money and artificially boost different growth indicators like GDP or gross domestic product, you know, that essentially had the effect of making the economic headlines look good, even as people continued to report that their quality of life was declining, that they could afford less than last year or 4 years ago, whatever the case may be. And that is why when we polled people throughout the last couple of years, we routinely got responses where more than half of those polled said, yes, I think we're in recession because my personal financial situation is worse now than it was 6 months ago or 12 months ago. And so, again, unfortunately, a lot of these official metrics, quote unquote, just aren't very reliable indicators anymore. And that's why as we listen to people like the Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent talk about how forget government, we need to get the private sector growing again. You know, you may actually see some of those official indicators like GDP turn negative because the government will be spending so much less money. But I don't care about the government. What I care about is how is the average American doing? How is the private sector doing? Because that's the productive part of the economy. That's what we should actually be focusing on. And as long as that is growing, I'm going to consider that a win. And frankly, if the government shrinks, I'm going to also consider that a win, even if it puts some of those headline economic numbers into the red. Again, I don't care about the government bureaucrats. I don't care about their standard of living. Mm-hmm. I don't care how much government is spending. I care about how much can the family spend, not how much can the federal government spend.
EJ and Tony, sometime I would love to watch, just flip around with mainstream media and see you react to it, because you're actually a scientist. And so the difference, I would relate it to the average person as to if you were watching someone give the weather and they were actually a scientist and a meteorologist versus somebody going, oh, yeah, see a few clouds up in the sky. And then we have in our society the media bias. It's really, it must be upsetting to you because you're somebody, you're actually a monetary scientist and you follow the science.
Yeah, exactly. And see, this is where, Dawn, it gets so incredibly frustrating when you have people like the previous White House press secretary who would get up to the microphone and purposely confuse terms for political ends. You know, she would say things like, oh, well, you know, inflation has come down and we're working very hard to make sure that that we continue seeing prices fall. Wait, what do you mean prices fall? Inflation coming down and prices coming down are not the same thing. Inflation is the rate of increase. Just because your rate of increase slowed doesn't mean you're still not increasing. Dawn, I liken it to if you're driving down the highway, imagine you're flying down the Schuylkill, right? And all of a sudden you hit a traffic jam and you go from 60 miles an hour down to 20 miles an hour. Now, you're still moving forward, right? Mm-hmm. Albeit slower, and the mile marker on the side of the road is still going to keep going up. So the mile marker is like the price level. It's still rising. It's just going up slower than it was before because you're not flying down the highway anymore. You're stuck in traffic on the Schuylkill yet again. So that's essentially what we've seen with inflation. So the idea that they will purposely confuse terms like the inflation rate or the level of prices for political ends, you're right. It is incredibly frustrating, and it takes a lot of work to really get the word out to people and explain, no, here's what these things actually mean. Here's what the data are telling us. Here's what's really going on. Frankly, that's one of the reasons why I love shows like yours so much, is because it gives us a chance to correct the record for folks.
Well, I love when you're on, love hearing you explain. You make it seem so simple. EJ Antoni, research fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Grover Herman Center for the Federal Budget. My goodness, your research is incredible. I see you everywhere, hear you everywhere. EJ Antoni, I can't wait till next time. Thank you so much.
Dawn, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dawn Stensland from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.